Come over here, kid. Why, sir? You never know, you might have to cook for 20 guys someday. You see? You start out with a little bit of oil. You fry some garlic. Then you throw in some tomatoes, tomato paste, you fry it, you make sure it doesn't stick. You gotta do a boil, you shove in all your sausage and your meatballs. Huh? Have a little bit of wine. A little bit of sugar.
Delicious.
And that's my trick.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie, that's amore.
Enough. I'm so sick and tired of hearing you people talk about food, food, food. That's all anybody ever talks about is prosciutto, cheese, and fava beans. I'm drowning here.
Jesus Christ, take it easy.
We're not even engaged yet.
When you're married, you'll understand the importance of fresh produce.
I eat with gusto, damn your bet, my country, tis of thee. I eat for social progress, I eat for victory.
Delicious.
Stay hungry, stay hungry, stay hungry.
You want some more?
Good evening and welcome to Mouthful, the wine country's most delicious hour. It's Michelle, Anna, Jordan. How you doing this evening? Did you have a nice weekend? Nice day? Did you go to the Sebastopol Farmers Market? It was packed. Opening day. It is one of my favorite days of the year, and it was just great to see everybody. So many people that you don't see at other markets. Paul Thornton of Paul's Smoked Salmon. A lot of the same people, though, of course. You see them at the market in Santa Rosa, see them at other markets. But it's just great to be there in Sebastopol, my hometown. And also, there was this great band. I don't know what they were called, but they were women really dressed up. They had some great red shoes on. And they were almost like the Andrews Sisters style of four women there singing. One was, playing piano. But they were doing a lot of Motown in addition to some older songs. And they were not young girls. They had gray hair. They sounded great. They looked great. It was really a blast. Very, very cool. At first, from a distance, I thought, oh, is this the Fondettes? The Fondettes are a band you should know about as well. The name comes from fondue. They're four girls from Santa Rosa High School, I believe, and they just really, really like fondue, and so that's what they called themselves. And they do, again, the Andrews Sisters style of things, a lot of a cappella, and they are adorable. They are really good, and they are all going to Sonoma State. So even though they're graduating this year, they're going to be around. So I'm hoping to get them here in the studio. And if they do get scheduled to play at one of our farmers markets, I will definitely be letting you know about that here on Mouthful. We're going to do something a little different tonight, something that we haven't done in a while, though I have done it before. It's just me. It's actually me and the boys. Lawrence, Mouthful's engineer, Kainoa, who is helping produce Mouthful. He is also on the phones, and you. So are you ready to make a phone call? Got some things, some options, but anything that's on your mind, a question, a request for a recipe, especially if it's, you know, don't ask me how to make really good lasagna, because that's not really something you tell. That's better something to be read, and I would certainly send you a recipe by email. But if there's something you want to know the best way to prepare asparagus, it is just popping out of the ground right now. And there's a really great, simple way that if you aren't cooking it like that, you will from the first time you try it. So things like that. If you have questions about restaurants, if you have a tip about a restaurant, an experience you'd like to share, a restaurant discovery, a rant, rants are welcome on Mouthful as well. And as an enticement to get you to call, first of all, write down the number so that you can. It is 588-0637, 588-0637. And if for any reason that phone isn't answered when you call, just hang up and call back in a few minutes. There's just one, and it's Kainoa who's answering the phone. But what I'm going to do is, at the end of the night, I'm going to take everybody's name, and at the end of the night, we're going to do a drawing, and I'm going to give away a cookbook. I was thinking that I would make it California Home Cooking. I wrote the book 12 years ago. It's got about 450 recipes. So if you don't have a copy, if you do have a copy and you like it and you want to give it to somebody else, you got a shot at winning it if you're one of the people who calls in. You don't have to be on the air. If you have a question and you would prefer to have it passed on to me, that is okay too. But the number 588-0637 is the number if you would like to join us. And I should tell you that I brought in certain of my books. I brought in tomatoes, oil and vinegar, mustard, salt and pepper, polenta, the BLT cookbook, the New Cook's Tour of Sonoma and California Home Cooking. So if you ask me a question that I can't quite remember, I should be able to refer to find the answer in one of these books. But one of the things that's on my mind, other than what I've just said, is meat. Eating it, not eating it, animals in general, the entire ecosystem that we live in. Jeffrey Mason has a new book out. You may know him. He was a psychotherapist. I remember him, I think, in the early 90s, talking on another radio station about debunking Freud. I think that's how he got famous. And then he wrote a book, When Elephants Weep, that got a lot of praise as well. Now he's out with a book called The Face on Your Plate, The Truth About Food. He lives in Australia now and has become a vegan. And you can sort of think of this book as one person's sort of philosophical musings on how animals are treated and how they should be treated. At the same time, there's another book that arrived on my desk a few months ago, Beef, The Untold Story of How Milk, Meat, and Muscle Shaped the World. And that's sort of a broader perspective, an historical perspective. It's written by Andrew Remus and Evan D.G. Fraser of England. And it is really interesting, really, really thoughtful. And I don't see it as having quite the same agenda as Mason's book. And I have to say, Mason's book seems very much to be the perspective of if you're eating meat or if you're not a vegan, you're in denial. And if you would just really wake up out of that denial, you would stop doing what he considers abusing animals. So I'm curious your thoughts on that. If you are a vegetarian, one of the questions I would love for someone to answer and explore, I don't think there is an answer, but something I always want vegetarians to tell me is, let's say everyone became a vegetarian right now, what would happen to the animals that have been raised for meat? What would happen to the chickens? What would happen to all of the different animals if we just suddenly stopped? And you can go at that from two different ways. You can go at that from lots of different ways. But two of the ways I think about that is, well, let's make the first assumption that they're just not going to procreate randomly. Would anyone be able to care for them and perpetuate their existence? Would a whole lot of species go extinct because no one is ultimately eating them? So that's one thing. And if we do find it, if we were to all become vegetarians, would we be able to find a way to keep these animals that have historically been to provide food for humans in various ways, not just as meat, as milk, cheese, butter, yogurt, all different sorts of things? What would the relationship between humans and animals in some really concrete way, what would the financial situation look like? So I'm just curious, if you think about these things, give us a call here on Mouthful. And where did that number go? 588-0637 is the number to call.
Grapes are covering the grassland. They're buying up for family farms, selling up. Who can blame them? Wine's a cash crop growing
just have to love. You're listening to Mouthful. We're just talking tonight. We hope that you might be joining us talking. 588-0637 is the number. You can call with a rant, a question, a tip, anything at all. And if you do call, your name gets entered into a drawing to receive a cookbook at the end of the night. So there you go, 588-0637. All kinds of things on my mind. And Lawrence, I'm just going to put you on the spot right here, and I'm not going to say what you think I'm going to say. But is it possible to talk a little bit about the Sunflower Project, since we just played that song about bees?
Oh, I don't know what I know about the Sunflower Project.
But you're going to get, it's these women.
Right, in San Francisco State University. Yeah, they're doing a census, and they've distributed seeds, and what they're collecting data.
A bee census, right?
Yeah, yeah, sunflower seeds, I should say. And they want to know, within a given period of time, how many bees have landed on your sunflowers. And I don't know much more than that.
Yeah, no, I've heard other people talking about it. And do they have a website?
Gosh.
Did you find them through a website?
They certainly do, yeah. Mm-hmm. I heard a radio bit, and, you know, I can really quickly go to the web and find that out
for
you.
We can just do here. You can even just keep talking, and I can do that right now.
I don't know what more to say about them.
On my new little MacBook. We'll just keep talking.
I know they've had a problem with getting the seeds out. Uh-huh. They refreshed their list. There was a request for new addresses earlier. What was it, last week? I received a request to update their mailing list. I submitted my address again and yet haven't received the seeds.
Here we go. Here we are. Join the hunt for bees, the Great Sunflower Project, greatsunflower.org. So there you go. Greatsunflower.org. I think that would just be a really fun thing to do.
A very cool thing. They had problems last year. I remember family members received seeds that didn't germinate, and then they reiterated that on their website that they had problems with propagation, that a lot of the seeds that they distributed didn't work for people. So hopefully they'll have more success this year.
Yeah, so check that out. I'm going to check it out and see if I can get involved. I have a problem with, I think it's gophers eating my sunflowers, so I'll have to put them in a raised bed or something. But I love sunflowers. That's such a cool thing to do.
And pretty.
And pretty, very pretty. You know, if they get tall enough, it just makes you feel like a little kid again.
And like you can do something in the garden.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that too. Okay, we have a phone call. We have a question actually from Teresa. And Teresa, if you want to call back and narrow things down geographically, I might be able to give you, a better answer. But she wants to know about a good place for breakfast on Friday mornings. Do you ever go out to eat for breakfast?
Periodically.
Where do you go?
Howard Station in Occidental. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's people in Occidental. Old standby.
Yeah. I like breakfast at Willowwood in Greaton. I really love it. They have an egg salad sandwich that I really like having for breakfast. And I also like their, they do a smoked salmon sandwich. I like breakfast sandwiches. So there's two places, Howard Station, but there's some other ones. Della Fattoria in Petaluma has excellent breakfast. And so does, very short distance from Della Fattoria, is Water Street Bistro. Stephanie Rathskeller, I think is her last name. It's very close. Stephanie was the right-hand chef to Daniel Patterson when he was at Babette's and went on to become very well-known in San Francisco, now has Restaurant Qua. Well, Stephanie was right there, and you see her skills, her just phenomenal cooking skills, but in a very different context. Her scones, they make there. They're wonderful. She also has some breakfast sandwiches. Really a great place. They open at 7:30. She has two kids. I think they're probably getting close to their teens if they're not there already. Two girls, I think, maybe three. So she does not open for dinner. She's open for dinner once a month. And breakfast and lunch, and you won't find anything better, I don't think, than Water Street Bistro in Petaluma. It's right across the footbridge from Dempsey's. Della Fattoria is in the same block of Petaluma Boulevard, just two doors, I think it would be north of the little McNear Park there. And then there's also a place in Petaluma, I think it's Hallie's, H-A-L-L-E, Hallie's Diner. I think it's on Kentucky or 1 Street past Kentucky. They have really, really good waffles. They also have really good corned beef hash. Let's go up to Healdsburg. Certainly Downtown Bakery and Creamery is always a great place, and you see all your friends and neighbors if you happen to live in Healdsburg.
Do you know the guy on Piner Road that does waffles and chicken? I don't know anything other than the ad I've seen.
Waffles and chicken?
Yeah,
on Piner Road. No, but I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, I want to know more about that. I don't know. I thought maybe you had some familiarity with that.
No, I'll have to check it out.
Yeah. And I assume it's for breakfast. You know, I wouldn't think you'd be having waffles for dinner, but that's possible,
you never
I suppose.
Know. Oh, and then there's another place I just went to. Oh, I think it's called Fresh China or China Fresh. It is in Coddingtown. It used to be Genghis Khan, and it's right next to that sort of big Japanese place. And really nice man, Peter, runs it, and he's hired a dim sum chef.
And there is dim sum just the other side of the freeway from there, the dim sum restaurant
right,
next
dim sum
to the JC,
so we have,
or up the road from the JC.
Yeah, we have dim sum.
They don't
two places
open
now.
Early though. They don't open.
He's
like
opening
10 or
pretty
11.
Early, I think. So he has a dim sum, and he's doing a baked pork bun, but he's doing whole wheat flour instead of white flour. I was there the other night. Some people are some good friends of mine are friends with him, and they wanted me to go. So he actually served us some dim sum at night. Didn't have the pork buns though, because they have those in the morning. Also had a turnip cake, which is not anything I would ever order. It just doesn't sound quite right.
Like poi.
See, and I love poi, and I'm going to be eating poi. This time next week, I'm going to be eating poi.
Lucky you.
You have to have the right poi, and you have to have the right salt on the right poi. But anyway, turnip cake, it's not made of turnips. It's made of daikon.
Okay.
It's a translation thing going on there. So it was just this cake. It was sort of soft, but then fried and had this wonderful garlicky, very garlicky soy sauce on it. It was really good.
Oh, it's sounding good.
Yeah, it was really, really excellent. So that's the Chinese place on the north side of Coddingtown, right next to, it's pretty hard to miss. And I've never been there before, but I drive down sometimes to San Francisco for dim sum in the morning. It's nice to get it here. If you have a favorite breakfast place that you think we should pass on to Teresa, she's looking for a place for breakfast on Friday mornings. I'd like to look into Chloe's, too. Chloe's is up in that Industrial Avenue area by Kohl's Department Store, which I've never been to and probably couldn't find. But maybe it's the end of Airway Drive. I'm pretty sure Chloe's, it's a little French place. I think they're open 9 to 5 Monday through Friday. So you might check them out and see what, you know, as far as I'm concerned, if you can pretend you're French in the morning, that's always a good thing. And then there's the hardcore. If you want to eat outside or in a tent, there's hardcore.
Hardcore coffee?
Hardcore coffee.
That's not really breakfast, is it?
It's not really breakfast unless you think, you know, a big cup of espresso is breakfast.
And sometimes it is.
It is. I think they have bagels too. So there you go with breakfast. And I was going to talk about bees. That's why we played. You know, I wanted to talk about the Sunflower Project, because one of the points that Jeffrey Mason makes in his book, or one of the points he made on the air about being a vegan, is why should we feel we have the right to steal from bees? So I would love it if somebody had more knowledge than I have on this or had an opinion. 588-0637 is the number, 588-0637. From what I've done, I love bees. I love reading about bees. My God, I think bees are just so interesting in their behavior. They don't know how to stop making honey. It's like a chicken. A chicken makes an egg. A chicken doesn't need a rooster. A chicken just needs to have the space and comfort and diet to let it do its chicken thing. And lo and behold, every 24 to 28 or 29 hours, a chicken makes an egg. And it, if it's a girl, and it can't not make an egg. And so, and bees, the worker bees, the girls, again, something going on there in the world, natural world. The bees can't stop producing honey. So it seems to me that if we have a good relationship and take care of bees, they're doing several things for us. They're pollinating, which is hugely important. A lot of things would cease to exist if we didn't have bees pollinating them. Same is true, getting off subject a little bit, there's something like 800 foods that wouldn't exist if we didn't have bats pollinating them. So
bats.
Bats. Bats are responsible for pollination of, I think it's at least 800 foods that humans eat.
How about hummingbirds?
Hummingbirds, I don't know. But start thinking about all the different red fruits, red foods. They tend to drink from red things as much as they can. They see red really well. They keep coming in my living room because it's red. Oh. I have to put little napkins over them and take them out. But yeah, pollination is really important. We have to keep our bees healthy. Bees, my understanding is, a bee, let's say it gets into, say they form a hive, a colony in your wall. They eventually will produce so much honey, they have to swarm and go somewhere else. And I think the same is true in the wild. They'll just fill up a hollow tree or whatever. They'll swarm and they'll go somewhere else. So if you're managing hives and keeping your bees happy, taking out that honey, but leaving enough in any beekeeper, and we have so many in Sonoma County, beekeepers take out honey, but leave more than enough for the bees to get through the winter when, you know, maybe there's not so much nectar out there for them. So is there a problem, you know, in your mind, if you're a vegan, why is it not okay to interact with bees in that way? I'm not baiting anyone. I'm really, really curious what that explanation is.
You're wondering about the harvesting of the honey. Are you stealing their food?
Are you stealing their food? Are you really harming them? Is there a deficit to the bees? Is there something wrong?
I wonder, and is there a manageable level at which we can harvest and be sustainable?
Yeah.
To use that great word?
Yes. because one thing I know, it's certainly in the interest of a beekeeper to, in a way, you're not even really, they're not captive bees. I mean, they're not a feral colony. A feral colony is a colony in a tree, in a wall, is in something that no one manages. But once you have bees, they can go somewhere else at any time. Mm-hmm. You know, I have two colonies at my house, and I didn't realize when I was watching, but they swarmed one day, and the guy who takes care of the bees just came and said, the queen's gone. The bees are gone. There's just a few sitting out there on the porch smoking, and, you know, nobody's working. So in the end, they're not even your bees. When you're managing a hive, they still can go off. I mean, they go out every day. They go, I think it's a 2-mile radius to collect nectar. And that's, again, that's what bees do. Bees work. They talk to each other about where the, you know, they do their little dances to direct their worker sisters to where the good honey is. So,
you know, as an aside, I've seen... I can't read what that says.
Oh, we're supposed to call Paul, who wants to talk about if everyone was a vegetarian.
Oh, so you want me to call? Okay. I've seen a large presence of bumblebees in my garden this year. I mean, probably in equal numbers to...
Oh, Paul's on. Okay, oh. Paul's ready to go. Cool.
Hello, okay. Paul.
Who am I talking to?
It's Michelle.
Hi, Michelle. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you?
Good. I feel good that you've posed the question, okay? And apparently you have read... I tuned in just a few minutes ago. Apparently, you've read Jeffrey Maisel's book, Face on the Plate.
I've read parts of his book, The Face on Your Plate.
Okay, then you've got to. You know, I'm only up to what the hell are we up to? We're up to Pigs at the beginning of Pigs.
Uh-huh. You're probably fine. I sort of skimmed through it.
Okay, well, from the just part, I get a general sense of where he's going and what he's saying. The first thing is, putting the ethical part aside for one second is the fact we are literally destroying the planet with the way we're raising animals. Even mm-hmm. if you don't give a hoot about animals, literally destroying the planet. John Robbins demonstrated this many, many, many years ago in his book, Diet for a New America. Jeffrey Maisel is showing much more, I think, than Robbins showed, the sensitivity and intelligence of these creatures, of all these creatures. And we just have no business doing this. Now, when one says, well, we're the concept, well, first of all, as far as concept is concerned, I've been struggling towards vegetarianism for years. It's not easy. So even if one was to say, "Oh yeah, well we're going to do this or attempt to do it," it would take years and years and years, and it would happen. It would not only happen gradually, but that's it. It would happen very gradually. Thirdly, just to live with ourselves, to kill, especially the way we do it, Michelle.
Oh, I have no argument. And when it comes to caring for animals, and the whole idea to me that someone needs to be convinced that animals are sensitive, aware, form bonds both with humans, with each other, and cross other species. I don't need any convincing whatsoever.
Great. I'm talking to the choir there.
Yeah, as far as that sort of thing goes, absolutely. No okay. convincing. But my question is sort of twofold. If this were to happen, yes, it would take a long time. But Jeffrey says all animals should have the right and be afforded the opportunity to live out their natural lifespan.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm just sort of, it's sort of a little intellectual exercise here. How do we make that happen as a planet? And how do we continue to support the species, all the diverse species that might not be, we wouldn't have them if they didn't provide meat, all the, say, the different breeds of, say, milk cows as well. So just how would we make that look?
I don't have an easy answer to that.
Uh-huh. Okay,
but I would like to reflect mm-hmm. something you just said. I'm talking to the choir here to you in the sense of your knowledge, understanding, and compassion of how the animals experience each other. And most people, it's going to take a long time, I believe, to cross that barrier of people believing the way they do, you know, that a steak is just a steak and doesn't have an origin of like a cow, or that for them to really assimilate or take in the information about how chickens are raised or how pigs are raised. This is going to take a long process. Just like slavery, it took forever and ever, a couple hundred years for us to begin to move around with this. So, first of all, it's not going to happen overnight, just a thinking process. Secondly, I really don't know how this would happen, how it would gradually lessen. And that's what I think would occur, would gradually mm-hmm. lessen. And with it would become replacement type way of doing it. It would probably be like more like the natural free roaming. And then gradually that would lessen and lessen. I honestly don't believe it'll happen in our lifetime. I don't think it's an issue we have to worry about.
No, I don't. I agree with you. I don't think it'll happen.
In our lifetime or the next lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? But I think to know what Jeffrey is saying and then have to address that with ourselves to be able mm-hmm. to see animals with care and understanding of what they're experiencing and to realize we have no business at all doing what we're doing. And then they have to say, well, where are we going to go from there? I don't know where we're going to go from there. Hopefully we'll move to the direction of living in compatibility with them.
Okay, and I think we see some, I think we're really lucky here in Sonoma County and in other areas like this.
Yeah, we do see cows grazing at least.
We see cows grazing, but not only that, you know, I get my eggs from chickens that I know.
Uh-huh.
You know, we have that really close up possibilities with nature. And if you have kids and you're not getting your kids out to really see that, I think that that's a really important thing to do. Well, thank you so much for your call.
And thank you for posing the question.
You bet.
Bye now.
Bye-bye. Okay, we have some comments about breakfast. And, oh, yes, my face is red for forgetting Dirk's Parkside Cafe. Absolutely wonderful place. Mark Dirkhuizing. It is just the greatest spot. He's been doing dinners as well once a month, but he stops those. The last one is coming up. I think it's the last Friday night in April. Really nice dinners. He's got a great family wine cellar, and every now and then they bring in these amazing bottles. But as far as breakfast goes, he has fabulous corned beef hash, speaking of meat. He also had, I had a breakfast sandwich there the last time I was there. I was still sort of mourning not being in New Orleans. And I thought, oh, this sounds a little bit like a muffaletta. I'll try it. It was good, and it's just a very pleasant place to be, Mike. Dirk's Parkside Cafe, not Mike's Parkside Cafe. Mark Dirkhuizing is just a really warm guy. It's a great space. Also, Carlos's Country Kitchen. It opens at 5 a.m., a caller tells us. Biscuits and gravy and enchiladas. Do you like enchiladas for breakfast?
I think I would had I had them.
You know, tacos for breakfast, especially if you stay up until 3 a.m. and you can go find
chorizo.
A taco truck
and
open.
Eggs and, yeah. Mm.
Yeah. And then also the chicken and waffles is at Red Rose Cafe at 1770 Piner.
There you go.
So I think this is all from June in Santa Rosa. So thanks very much, June. We're going to come back and talk some more. Okay, the number, if you want to join in the conversation, the number 588-0637, 588-0637. If you're listening online, not in the area code, 707 is what you have to add beforehand. Lawrence, I think you just really, off mic, hit the nail on the head where food production, ripping down the rainforest to grow food to feed industrial cattle. And for me, the bigger issue is industrial food production.
Yeah, well, land use.
Land use.
It would be my objection.
Yeah, land use. And for me, it's industrial food production. Like I think about, I think it's the Watu, I forget if it's the Maasai tribe who work with Watusi cattle, or if it's the Watusi tribe. It might be the Maasai who have Watusi cattle. You can learn about this up at Safari West. There's this herd of amazing Watusi cattle. They're the ones with the huge, huge, huge horns. And the Maasai who have, if what I've been told is accurate, have the best teeth on the planet.
Really?
Really strong, healthy, cavity-free teeth. And let me get their diet right. They drink the milk of the Watusi. Milk, blood, and urine is from the Watusi cattle is the primary. That's the bulk of their diet.
No leafy greens? No chard?
They haven't heard about chard. Haven't heard about
sources.
Leafy green. No.
No fluoride in their water?
Nope. Urine, blood, and milk of the Watusi cattle.
Wow.
Now, what is that? That is really... And then you can also look up at certain tribes in Alaska, the ones who live on seal and whale blubber. So this sort of industrial global food production has really sort of muddied the water to understanding, I think. And you mentioned also Raj Patel, who's a guest on Mouthful back in maybe December, January.
Just about a couple months ago, yeah.
Yeah, brilliant, brilliant thinker. RajPatel.org, if you want to take a look. And you signed up for his blog?
Great blog, yeah.
Tell us a little bit about him.
He doesn't post very often. In fact, I don't think I've seen a posting in the last couple of weeks, but appropriate land usage is one of his big issues, you know, and he travels the world. He's a, what is it, a resident scholar, visiting scholar at Cal?
Yeah, he says what that means, visiting scholar, and he says what that means is he gets to use the library.
Yeah.
So I've actually been a visiting scholar at Cal, too.
Very cool to have that at your disposal. But just, as you said, a brilliant guy, you know, an incredible thinker. And, you know, hits on all these really important topics. When he was here for Mouthful, he talked about land use and he talked about the rainforests and the inappropriate use of soy to feed cattle. Also the exploitation of corn. You know, I think we're all pretty familiar with, was high fructose corn syrup in just about everything these days, you know, because of the incredible subsidies it receives and, you know, people get paid to grow it. And don't know any better, it seems. They just continue to do so regardless. What have we got?
We have another question. Oh, Shari in Santa Rosa wants to know, what is a raw food diet and why?
Seems you just don't cook things, right?
You know, it's actually a little more complicated than that. You can get really complicated. That's one way to go. And certainly I've known people who did that. You know,
well, how about pickling? Is that... Would that be considered cooking?
Well, it would depend because some, I think...
Is ceviche a raw food?
It is. Ceviche is raw food, but I don't know if it fits. And so is poke.
But, ooh, poke. Bring some back with you, would you?
Well, the raw food diet, you know, other than somebody who just eats fruits and vegetables and greens that have not been cooked at all, sure, that's the simplest. And then, oh gosh, it's been... a good 10 years, maybe more, that there was this guy in San Francisco, the chef, who has since moved to Los Angeles. And I hear he's doing really well. And it's certainly been going on for raw food diet has been going on longer ago than that. But he sort of brought it to the attention of the food community. He had a very big personality. And then there was, was it Roxanne's down in Larkspur, which was a high-end restaurant. And a takeout cafe, sort of the very high end, and then the little more accessible, 100% raw. So the people who adhere to a strict raw food diet believe that heating ingredients, I think it's over 117 or 118 degrees, destroys enzymes and other nutrients that are essential for health. They also, for the most part, not exclusively, but most of the raw food diets that I've seen tend towards vegan as well. I have seen a couple where maybe there is some fish, maybe there are some eggs, but for the most part, no. And so for dairy products, you see a variety, particularly nuts, milk made from almonds, maybe milk made from pecans, that sort of thing. You see bread made out of ground sprouts and maybe ground nuts and other crushed, possibly crushed and ground grains dried in the sun sometimes. You can get very, very fancy with the food. This guy who had his restaurant, and it might have been called Raw, I'm not positive. He was right near, I think near Irving, near the panhandle of Golden Gate Park. He had an interesting contradiction. He would say, well, man ate long before man had fire. Man was eating. Therefore, the best diet is the raw diet. But his whole cooking line was made up with blenders. It's like, we had fire before we had electricity. There's like, you got to say a little bit more to convince me. You know, that just seemed, you know, hypocritical to me.
One thing occurs to me, we had some folks talking about mushrooms a few months back.
Right.
And they were saying that we're not capable of digesting mushrooms.
Oh, you've heard me say that several times.
Yeah, and they need to be.
The agaricus mushroom, which is the basic white, my number are agaricus. The white mushroom, cremini, portobello. My understanding, and I've done some reading about it, is that first we can't break down the cell walls to release the nutrients without cooking them. And also, there's an ingredient, and I really need to know the chemistry. I never remember this name, that is very, very similar to rocket fuel, and that is neutralized when it's heated above a certain level. And so that spectrum of mushrooms is supposed, I mean, you can find endless articles on why those mushrooms will kill you, and I haven't noticed it happening.
And you said the vitamins are destroyed in vegetables when they're
the
cooked.
The enzymes in particular. Enzymes is what I hear about a lot is
okay.
Enzymes.
Okay, that makes sense because enzymes being a living entity, they'd essentially be killed, I suppose. But I was under the understanding, and obviously not being a biochemist, I don't know that this is the case, but I thought that the, say, if you were boiling or steaming, aren't the nutrients released to the water, or say the vitamins at least released to the water? And if you were to, say, drink the water that you steamed your asparagus in?
I don't think you should steam asparagus. However, well, think about a soup. You put some asparagus into a soup. You put potatoes into a soup. Yes, the vitamins are released into that liquid.
But not lost.
But not lost. So it's a raw food diet is controversial. Some people claim that when they start a raw food diet and go on to and continue it for a few weeks, they feel really, really good. Now, I even know somebody who went on a raw food diet, a totally different kind of raw food diet, which I didn't quite understand for a while. He was eating raw beef mixed with these other things every day. That was, I mean, he was trying to cure himself of, you know, God knows what. He's kind of a nut. So there are a lot of different kinds of raw food diets. All of them seem to have the perspective that applying heat above a certain amount reduces the health benefits. One of the things I feel, I compare this in a way to almost addressing any form of addiction. Like, let's say you drink too much and you decide that that's not a good idea. So you go to AA and it's effective. Now, was it AA that was effective? Or was it the fact that you did something? You made the decision to address it and you did something. So let's say you're eating at McDonald's and you're just not eating well and you're not really just paying attention to your diet and you decide to go on a raw food diet and you feel better. Was it the raw food diet? Or was it that you took your diet in hand and changed your eating habits? So I think that doing something and paying attention to what you eat, and for me, personally, paying attention to what I eat is important. And I learned if I have too much carbohydrate, and I'm not on any you know, extreme diet at all. But for a while, I was eating dinner with some friends several nights a week. And we almost always had a pasta-based dinner. And I just started realizing if I eat too much simple carbohydrates like that, I don't feel so good.
You get logy.
Yeah, there you go. I feel better with fruits, vegetables, and animal protein. That just tends to be sort of my target range. But we have to talk a little bit. And you can still call. There's still time to call. 588-0637. We have three people right now who are in the drawing for a cookbook. So you can get into if you want to call, ask a question, and have Kainoa convey it to us or talk on the air here on Mouthful. This hour has gone by really fast, but we have to talk about asparagus. I talked about this when I was on The Crush, and I would get all kinds of emails about it if people missed it. And every year I try to tell more people about it because it's such a great way to cook asparagus. Turn on your oven, 450 to 500 degrees. I usually do 450. Sometimes I do 475. And then take that stalk of asparagus and snap it. Put your whatever hand is your strong hand, put that on the fattest end and hold it, and then just snap it, and it will snap off where it starts to get tough. It'll snap off where it wants to. And then get a baking sheet, doesn't matter what kind of baking sheet, just something, and put the tiniest bit of olive oil over the asparagus, not even over, just enough to lubricate it, that you're not flavoring it, you're just lubricating it. Sprinkle a little bit of salt. When that oven's hot, put the asparagus in. Now, if it's as big as your finger or a pencil, it's going to be done in 5 to 7 minutes. If it's as big as a big fat thumb, 12 to 15. It's not diluted. Boiling and steaming makes the outer part that chefs in a fancy restaurant will peel away if they steam it. So it doesn't get that skin, that very, very thin skin, doesn't get stringy. It doesn't get diluted from the water or the steam. It concentrates the flavors. The texture is fabulous. Even if you cook it too long, like, oh, oops. It's so good cooked that way. There you go.
Different vegetable? How about okra? How do you cook okra and not have it be slimy?
Okay. Have you ever cooked nopales?
No, but I know what they are. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I have cooked nopales more often than I've cooked okra. So I'm not an okra expert.
I just bought some in Santa Rosa a couple days ago.
Nopales?
No, okra.
Okay.
Yeah.
This is what I believe you do. And I need to try it a few more times before I'm 100% positive. But it works every time with nopales. There's a woman at the Santa Rosa Farmers Market. She should be there in another month or so, I hope. She chops the nopal. I don't really believe in having someone else do the stuff for you. But I love to be able to grab a bag of already diced nopales that have the little...
Skins it, takes the
little
spines out.
You put it in a dry pan, and in about 30 seconds, slime oozes out. It's the same sort of slime that okra oozes out. Have the flame on low enough that it's not going to burn, and then just evaporate the slime.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
You just have to cook the nopales, because I like to put nopales in enchiladas. Sometimes I put them in tacos. And I also make sort of a California-style succotash with nopales in it, they have a nice tart flavor. I really like them. You just have to cook it long, because people say, oh, God, it looks just like okra.
Well, I had read something online, and it didn't work. They said use a really hot frying pan with oil, and that didn't work for me.
What happened?
It was slimy. It was great. I mean, I love the okra, but, you know.
You just have to cook long enough for that albumin-like stuff to evaporate. Now, like I said, I haven't done it enough to be completely positive.
Huh. I didn't want to cook it to the point where it got mushy, you know? So I wanted it to be somewhat...
You want everything, you know.
I do. And I want it now.
That's going to be a bit of a problem. So let's see. What would I experiment with? I might put them in water, in a frying pan. Water, get the albumin, cook them long enough for that albumin to release, and then pour it into a colander or strainer and see if that gets rid of the slimy stuff.
Maybe rinse it even, huh?
Maybe rinse
Something
it.
Like that.
I mean, then you rinse it away some vitamins.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
So we're going to take one. Do we have time for another musical break? We have that perspective we were going to play.
Oh, yeah.
Should we play that?
We can do both.
Okay. Here's another thought. This we heard on a few weeks ago on KQED's perspective program, and I think it's fine for us to play it. It's another thought about meat. So see what you think.
Kevin Fingerman is the
thank you.
The journalist here.
These days, especially here in the Bay Area, ground zero of the foodie movement, meat is trendy. Many of the people who 10 years ago were militant vegetarians are now making their own salami and subscribing to the indie zine Meat Paper. Michael Pollan, crown prince of California gastrophilosophy, has written at length about his experiences hunting for boar in Sonoma County, and all the hippest chefs are taking butchery lessons, sourcing their beef by the half cow. Meanwhile, my friend Novella has been raising goats and pigs for slaughter on her urban farm in West Oakland. It landed her a book deal. Not only is meat trendy these days, but we as a society seem to have some strange ideas about animals and their place in the world. Sarah Palin runs for vice president, while Michael Vick sits in jail, in part because we like dogs more than we like moose. A close friend of mine has told me that he doesn't feel he should be willing to eat anything he wouldn't be willing to kill personally, and I think that's an awesome sentiment, in theory. I'm also a professional environmentalist and climate change geek, and I can't help but return to the fact that production of the average grain-fed hamburger in this country emits almost 7 pounds of greenhouse gas into the atmosphere, or about the same carbon footprint as a drive across town in an SUV. You're probably assuming I don't eat meat, and you're wrong. I eat it almost every day. I probably don't eat it as much as I would if my fiancé weren't a vegetarian, but that's for logistical reasons rather than ethical ones. So yeah, I'm an omnivore, or perhaps I should say a hippocrivore, eating my hypocrisy for dinner, since I can list any number of reasons why none of us should really be eating this stuff. I can even read them out on public radio and still probably have a carne asada burrito for lunch. I guess when I think about it, my only real ethical compass in this was put best in the immortal words of John Travolta in Pulp Fiction. Bacon tastes good. With a feels like frying your bacon butt naked. How you tempt me, darling, and you torture me. Loving you's like frying bacon butt naked. That's how I feel when you get through with me. You think I'd know? You think I'd learn? A trucker falls in love. A trucker's gonna get burned. There's just one thing I want you to pledge. You can burn my bacon, but don't you dare scorch my sausage.
Ah, it's mouthful. What else would it be with a song like that, huh? Thanks to everyone who's called. I should tell you that I'm going to be gone for the next 2 weeks. I will be in Hawaii. Oh, boy, I can't wait. I'm going to guess that there's going to be a special on next Easter Sunday, and then we will be airing an archive of mouth. Well, we've got a lot of archives now, given that I've been doing this 13 years. So all three of us are going to take a much-needed short vacation. So thank you for all the phone calls. Lawrence, thanks for joining in. And now I told you that if you joined in, you were going to be put in the drawing for a cookbook. The one I'd chosen was California Home Cooking, but if you already have that or if it's one you didn't want, I could probably come up with something else for you. And right now I'm going to have...
The hopper's spinning.
It is spinning, spinning, spinning. Okay.
Tumble those numbers. All three of them.
No, there's four.
Oh, four.
So, okay.
I have, and the winner is... I can't read that. Teresa?
Teresa, it's a bad pencil. Yeah. Teresa, you have won a cookbook, and since you didn't give us your phone number, you have to either send me an email at catsmilk@sonic.net so I can tell you how to claim your cookbook, or as soon as I quit talking, give us a call here at that same number, 588-0637. Have a great Easter. Have a great holiday, whatever you're doing. I will see you 3 weeks from tonight. Aloha.
Some flip cornbread. Now listen to what the Mouthful is produced and hosted by Michelle Anna Jordan. Lawrence Alberti is Mouthful's engineer. For more information about Mouthful, send an email to mouthful@michelleannajordan.com. That's Michelle with one L. You can also download Mouthful's free podcast from krcb.org or from iTunes.